Yeah, Malcolm was talking with, and the word I think we might want to use is heavyweights. He was speaking with, as you say, Kwame Nkrumah, Azikiwe, and Nasser. What type of difficulties did this cause Malcolm? I mean, I'm sure you've taken a look at some of the FBI records and followed some of the speeches and the growth of kind of tension both national and within the Nation of Islam against Malcolm. What did this bring to Malcolm, the fact that he was an international leader at the same time that the civil rights movement was bubbling and boiling?
Well, you know, it's clear that the government intelligence agencies were, which of course is almost an oxymoron, but anyway, these agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Council, and so forth, knew that one of the greatest internal threats to the ruling class in this country is to have leadership that would unite a broad spectrum of people in the African-American community and among radical whites, because that's exactly who Malcolm was. That's also who King was becoming. In other words, we were developing our Ho Chi Minhs and our General Jiaps, to use examples of people in Vietnam. And there are common examples of other countries as well. In other words, one of the ingredients seems to be to have national points of reference, individuals that people can see and unite with. So Malcolm was clearly, not only was he that in relationship to the long tradition of black nationalism and to the field Negro, as he put it, but Malcolm had developed an articulate presence. He was very well read. He studied voraciously, read voraciously, and was drawing people to him. Many of the people who had come up through SDS had begun to identify Malcolm as a leader of the American Revolution. Now, this is very important. See, it's one thing to isolate black people off and do the black thing, right? That's dangerous enough. But when you get somebody who also not only commands a presence there, but begins to bring forward the idea that we could actually have an integrated revolutionary leadership force for all of the United States, then that's a serious question. Not unlike, again to use the King example, when King began the Poor People's Campaign. So when Malcolm becomes a revolutionary center, a revolutionary point of reference, but not one that is sectarian, one that is increasingly open and democratic, one that is increasingly honest and open in his self-criticism and in his appeals for unity, but still on the basis of principles with regard to struggle and with regard to a strategic goal, not compromising on a strategic goal. Literally, the ruling class establishment went berserk. It was absolutely essential to isolate and destroy him. And that's what happened. In other words, even inside the Nation of Islam, there were all kinds of diverse forces, and they had to move to isolate Malcolm completely. Whether this was Muhammad Ali, who Malcolm was very close with, or Malcolm's family, there were moves to cut Malcolm off. And then there was a reign of terror against Malcolm, phone calls, threats against himself, against his family. There were attempts on his life. House was firebombed. There were attempts to poison him in Africa. There were the French government denied him the entrance into the country when he was scheduled to go at the last part of his life to go there to speak to a unity meeting of black people in Paris. There were so many indications that they were out to get Malcolm. At the same time, it's almost like having a rendezvous with destiny. Malcolm resisted all efforts to slow down, take time off and go somewhere. So many countries offered him a safe haven where he could go and study and train people and play for the longer haul. Malcolm had a rendezvous with his own destiny. And when he, in the last days, began to feel the pressure more and more, it was as if he said that the greatest thing he could do would be to give his life. And I don't want to seem religious about it, but it was very Jesus-like, you know, to give his life so that we may all benefit from the knowledge of his life as a beacon to continue to struggle on a revolutionary path.
I guess there's some fact which was said at his obituary, I believe, by Ossie Davis, that he, that same type of analysis that you've just used. We're speaking with Dr. Abdullah Kalimat. He is a professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Toledo in Ohio. He is the cyber organizer for Malcolm X, a research site which can be found at www.brothermalcolm.net. He also works with www.e.blackstudies.
No, let me just correct you.
Okay.
It's www.eblackstudies.
eblackstudies.net. And that's where actually one can locate some of the online full text of particular things that are out of copyright.
That's right.
Good. You're listening to Dr. Kalimat here on Africa Today, where we talk every week about developments on Africa and related to the African diaspora. My name is Walter Turner, your regular host for Africa Today. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Kalimat back in the studios with us again, talking about Malcolm X. Abdul, you love Malcolm X. You love to talk about Malcolm X, don't you?
I sure do.
Yeah, I can sense it in your voice there. What's your favorite, if there is such a word, what's your favorite speech by Malcolm? Because I wanted to get into talking here a bit about some of the speeches in the latter period of time.
Yeah, I think that the two that work for me the most, and I say this because they were at a time of change. One is Message to the Grassroots, and the other is Ballot or the Bullet. But I have to quickly say that the speech that I really wanted to hear was always the next speech. In other words, I'm just sorry there aren't more. Because if you follow his speeches, there is a consistent, there are consistent themes, but he is constantly growing and developing. And that's what was so compelling. And his ability to teach about world history, about U.S. history, about contemporary policy issues, was just incredible. I mean, we have this expression, you know, cut it to the bone, meaning get down to the essentials, cut away the chaff and get to the essence of it. And that's how Malcolm could teach. And in ways that seem simple and yet clarified highly complex issues.
And some of these speeches, in fact, are on the Malcolm website, is that correct?
Yes.
Are they, so there's excerpts and then there's actually full speeches, are they not?
Yeah, on the website we've got several things. First, we've got some full text online. We've got some extended quotes. And then we've got sound bites from speeches. And what we're working on now is full speeches, audio of full speeches, and video clips. Now, the reason we haven't done that so far is because given the type of computers that are out there and the narrow bandwidth that's out there, which means how fast information can come across, the more we put audio and video up, the slower it'll be. But I think that the current generation of computers and people are changing and things are moving fast, so that soon, we hope, the full archive of Malcolm will be online for everyone to fully enjoy and to participate in.
Are there more speeches out there that you're still looking for?
Yes. We have no question that most, for example, of the speeches that Malcolm gave at colleges around the country, the vast majority are not in a collection of record. Most of the articles that Malcolm wrote, newspaper articles, including the early issues of Muhammad Speaks, as well as a column, God's Angry Man, or Men, those have not been made available. to the public, although they were obviously when in every case when they were given. And we hope to gather all this material up and put it online and make it available for people.
There's a speech, and I noticed I was reading the book, The Final Weeks of Malcolm X, and there is a speech in there which I think most of us refer to. It's titled on the album as The Last Message, but it's referred to as something else in the text. And in that particular speech, Malcolm is talking about the Congo, and he's talking about South America and the Caribbean. He's talking about nationalism and colonialism and imperialism. How do you assess where that speech was coming from? I think it was a week before his assassination, Abdul.
Mm-hmm. One of the important things about Malcolm is that not only was he constantly reading and learning, but he was constantly trying to integrate all this information. In other words, if you cover his speeches, you'll see that he's focused on this notion of we need a revolution in this country. So we got to come to grips with what is a revolution. But then we also have to come to grips with the fact that everybody in the world has needed one, certainly people in the third world, and the Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and therefore he wanted to know and to help us know how they came to an understanding that they needed a revolution and what they did so that we could learn from their experience. So he was constantly referring to China and Vietnam and Cuba and the African liberation struggles. But the important thing was he wasn't just passing along information. It's not like he read the newspaper that morning and then would put some factoids in his speech. Malcolm was trying to synthesize the information so that when you heard one speech, you got a holistic view of world politics, and most important of all, of the motion of politics. In other words, you got the real feeling that the world was moving to liberate oppressed nations and to have the kinds of political and moral confrontation that would advance the world to a higher level of human existence.
It's interesting because in the last message, Malcolm gives an analysis about the Congo and about Southern Africa, which pretty much seems to be right on the button.
See, the important thing about that Congo discussion is that Malcolm, remember, he's now a nationalist who, in the era of the fight against colonialism, when colonialism was white, in other words, white people have invaded Africa, that's an easy thing for black people to unite around. But when he taught about the Congo, he began to teach us about neocolonialism. He began to teach about how the Mobutu and Kasavubu and all of the degenerate collaborators with colonialism united to assassinate Patrice Lumumba and united to sell out the Congo to global Western interests, as he called them. And, you know, this was a very difficult thing to do, and yet Malcolm took it on and did it. And so that his discussion of the Congo, as far as I'm concerned, is a brilliant intervention into nationalist politics that says that that negates the notion that black is wrong, I mean that black is good and white is bad. It begins to say, wait a minute, you know, there's another way to look at this, and that has to do with who is working in the interest of the people and who is opposing and exploiting the people. And so the thing about the Congo, which lays the basis then for understanding the whole Mobutu regime and for, to some extent, understanding the Congo today. Because if in other words, if leadership like Malcolm existed today, there would be much more in public discourse about global affairs from the perspective that the majority of black people and the majority of poor people in this country could identify with. In other words, we don't have that today. We would have it if we had more leadership like Malcolm, and we had a black studies movement that was much more in the tradition of Malcolm X.
To the point of the African-American community, Abdul, I've heard a number of comments about, in fact, there's a piece that talks about Mumia Abu-Jamal, and essentially says, well, we couldn't save Malcolm, but we could save Mumia. Leaving that aside, what could our communities, these community of people who loved and cared about Malcolm, have done to have ensured that not just Malcolm, but the litany of leaders who were assassinated or killed in the 1960s, that might not have happened. I don't want to reverse history here, but obviously there's some ways to prepare for preventing your leaders from being snatched from you.
Well, there are two ways to approach that question. Obviously, one is an impossible discussion, which is the actual tactical issue of how Malcolm could have avoided the assassination the way it happened. I don't think that's realistic, given the general state of the struggle and so on. In other words, the power of this government and these corporations are such that they want to kill anybody.
Is that what we're talking about when we're talking about why Malcolm was assassinated?
Well, I think it's not a question of it's both a question of why and who, and I think that the only way to talk about it is to sort of posit out there the government, the major corporations, and other major interests that had the resources to do those things that I said were affecting him. I mean, it was a global attack on Malcolm. It was an attack that had the New York City Police Department complicit with what was going on. In other words, the day he was assassinated, suddenly all the cops disappear. And there are lots of questions that have never been really answered. But I think the way to answer your question really is to not talk about the Malcolm that was, but the Malcolm that will be. See, in other words, once the cards are dealt, so to speak, for a given historical moment, they're there to be played out. What we can do is to impact the way the deck is composed and how the hands get dealt. Right now, we are still struggling with the great person theory of history. That is to say that individuals like Malcolm and King become idols almost. While they're absolutely important, and I mean, I couldn't care more for a person than I do for Malcolm. But when we start talking about the freedom struggle, I think we have to start talking about not just a Malcolm, but a generation of Malcolms. And it becomes pretty everyday-ish, pretty mundane when you really get down to brass tacks. It's like the neighborhood elementary school. You know, at the end of Spike Lee's movie, when he has those kids stand up and they say, "I am Malcolm X." No, they're not Malcolm X. They're a little kid in elementary school. What they could say is, "I want to grow up to be like Malcolm X." Then it's the responsibility of the teachers, of the administration, of the parents, of the neighborhood, to help facilitate that kind of honest moral courage, that kind of vision, that kind of intellectual understanding, that kind of health. Malcolm was a healthy person. He wasn't taking Ritalin. He wasn't eating Kentucky Fried Chicken and chemicals like soda pop. He was drinking juices and eating real food. So I'm saying all those issues are combined when you start talking about a Malcolm X. So I would rather want to direct the discussion to looking at all the children in our community and saying they are all potential Malcolm X's. And the big thing we can control is their environment and their influences. And, of course, we're falling on the job. We're not doing a good job. And that's really the bottom line. The bottom line is, if we took that idea, if we really got that idea that what we want to do is create 10,000 Malcolm X's, and the black community really started trying to do that, it would be as important now as the ghost dance was for the Lakota people. When they started that ghost dance and turned inward and began to, then it completely put the U.S. Army on war footing because they understood that they were being threatened. And if we start actually trying to raise up a nation of Malcolm X's and begin to protect them with the same courage that Malcolm had, because, you know, many of us are alive today who were alive then, and we've all gone on to do other things, and we've got one last shot at making a difference, a great historical difference, and that's to prepare for the generations of struggle to come. And that's the way I'd like to really direct my answer to your question, that there was no way we could have prevented Malcolm from being killed, partly because it was Malcolm himself who decided on what his destiny was. But what we could do is learn from his life and contribute to this turning every elementary school into a nesting ground for the new Malcolm X's. And that can happen because there was nothing special about Malcolm. He was every young little dude in school who tried to study hard, who tried to do good, who had aspirations to get ahead, and who had the influences of our community, whether it was his father, a minister, and a active organizer for the UNIA Marcus Garvey movement, or his mother, or from the street, or from the traditions of black radicalism. I mean, all of that represents the collective wisdom and knowledge we have to mobilize for our children if we're to have the Malcolm X's of the 21st century.
In our last question, Abdul, are there some pieces? We certainly have your website, which is the brothermalcolm.net. Are there some one or two pieces of literature that you would suggest are priority reading on Malcolm X, or a visual that you would might suggest for the listeners who want to pick up and go further with this discussion?
Well, I think that, there are a couple of things I think that people should read. One of them is a book by Bill Sayles, which is a wonderful study of Malcolm in context in Harlem. Because it focuses on the years of the OAAU. And I think that Bill Sayles' book is really very, very important book. And I'm trying to remember the title of the book.
People can search it out, Bill Sayles.
Bill Sayles. And the second book, which I think is extremely important, is a book that has just been published on that period of time, and it's by Rod Bush, We Are Not What We Seem. Because what Bush does is he sums up Malcolm's life and the influences and so on, but he does it contextually, and then he talks about the legacy. That's really why I'm mentioning these two books. And they're written by people who teach at university but who are activists in the out of the 60s and really are the living examples of the kind of intellectual activism that Malcolm represented, teaching at Seton Hall and at St. John's in the New York area.
And you mentioned one other journal that you said has a good series of discussions that's recently come out.
Oh, yes. And now, and more generally in terms of black studies, I would mention to everyone the current issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, of all things, has five articles about black studies. And one of the articles is about the basic activity of radicals who are still keeping alive struggle in black studies. They're not postmodernists and they're not abstract historians, but are actively trying to link the intellectual work with the practical work of the liberation struggle. And so taking black studies back to the streets is the theme in the current issue of Chronicle of Higher Education. I might also add that there is a special article also on a course I'm teaching called Cyberspace and the Black Experience as an example of how black studies is retooling for the 21st century. So those would be also things I think would be very useful, because the important thing about Malcolm is it's not just what he did, but he inspired so many things to happen. I edited a book called Paradigms in Black Studies, and it's a collection of essays by people who demonstrate that Malcolm impacted a paradigm shift in history, in sociology, in theology, in every discipline. And the black arts movement. So when we say Malcolm, we also mean not just what he did, but all the things associated with his legacy. And so I think that this current debate in black studies should be paid attention to, because I think there's a new Malcolmist tendency on the rise.
for the last 55 minutes or so, we've had the pleasure of talking with Dr. Abdullah Kalimat, a professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Toledo at Ohio. He is the cyber organizer for the Malcolm X site, www.brothermalcolm.net. He also is an organizer with the www.eblackstudies.net. And Abdullah, it's always a pleasure. I'm a big reader, big thinker about the work and life of Malcolm X, and our listeners so much enjoyed the last program. I'm sure they're listening here with a lot of attention as to the information that you're sharing with us about Malcolm. And please stay in touch, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Abdul.
Okay.
Bye-bye.